Hi, we're Josh
and Arielle Wamsley,
owners of Green Valley Tree LLC, based in North Windham.
We're proud to sponsor Connecticut East this week and to serve the communities of Windham and New London counties with our tree removal and plant healthcare services.
Visit our website at greenvalleytreeworks.com for a full list of our services or give us a call on 860-234-4041. We look forward to hearing from you.
The Connecticut Port Authority's new executive director, John Henshaw, has been in office for 3 months. So what's changed at the quasi-public agency, once rocked by scandal and its contentious State Pier project in New London? Plus a look at other stories making the headlines from around the region. This is Connecticut East This Week. Hello, I'm Brian Scott-Smith. Back in 2019, the Connecticut Port Authority seemed to be doing well and was relatively unknown to the general public until a scandal over $3,000 worth of paintings revealed by The Day columnist Dave Collins started a roller coaster of other issues, including the eventual firing of the CPA's then executive director, Evan Matthews, for behavior unbecoming his position towards Port Authority critic Kevin Blacker, and also resignations by Port Chairman Scott Bates, followed closely by Bonnie Riemschneider, all of which dented the image of the authority and forced Governor Lamont and his office to step in to try and right the situation. Added on top of this, a controversial project to redevelop State Pier in New London for future offshore wind projects. With new oversight of the authority and a new executive director at the helm, how is the once scandal-hit Port Authority doing now? In his first exclusive interview with the press, the CPA's executive director, John Henshaw, spoke with Connecticut East this week. Mr. Henshaw, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, you're the new executive director of the Connecticut Port Authority. You've been in office now for about 3 months. It took the CPA about a year to find their new executive director, and you come with an impressive resume, and you're a former executive director of the Maine Port Authority. Quite simply, what are the taxpayers of Connecticut getting for their $200,000 a year being your salary, sir?
Thank you for the question. I took this job because I enjoy the work. I feel like I'm good at it. As you indicated, I held the same position in Maine for a little over a decade before leaving to take a job in higher education. The positions are remarkably similar, both in terms of organization and responsibilities. In Maine, I had responsibility for the state's three deep water ports, pilotage, and the Small Harbor Improvement Program, all similar to my responsibilities here. I worked with a variety of public and private sector partners. I even worked in the wind industry, co-founding a supply chain organization called the Maine Wind Industry Initiative. So I think those things are assets that I bring to the table.
Are there any other differences or challenges, you know, from Maine here to Connecticut that you'll have to deal with that is different here in Connecticut? And if so, what are those?
Well, every harbor is a little bit different, and there is a matter of scale. The scale is a little larger. New Haven is the second largest port in New England. It's mostly a matter of scale and obviously getting to know the all the partners and other folks that I need to work with, including, you know, the federal government and state and local governing bodies as well.
So just to be clear, I mean, the Connecticut Port Authority, it's a quasi-public agency. It was created back in 2014, so it's a relatively young agency. And its role, according to your website, is for the marketing and coordinating the development of the state's ports and maritime economy. What does that actually translate into reality? And which ports are you actually responsible for? Because my understanding is the three deep water ports that we have here in Connecticut, two of those are private. That's New Haven and Bridgeport, which would just leave New London. So can you just clarify that for us?
Sure. So, you know, as I indicated, every port is a little bit different. There are public assets and private assets in most ports. You know, I had a very similar situation in Maine where I worked with a municipal port authority in one of our ports. I worked with a private terminal operator in another port. And then I worked in another port with a variety of public and private terminals. So in that sense, it's very similar. And so there's various roles and responsibilities you have in each. So if you look at New London, there is a Port Authority owned asset in New London. And so we have specific responsibility for developing that in a responsible fashion. And then in New Haven, for instance, we are partnering with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers on a significant improvement project for the harbor down there. Similarly, in Bridgeport, we'll be working with the Army Corps of Engineers on a maintenance dredging project for that harbor. So it depends on where and who the partners are and how you can best leverage our assets and our expertise to improve the functioning of the ports.
As I said earlier in this interview, the CPA is a relatively young agency created back in 2014. You, myself, and many are aware that it has had its challenges over the past couple of years. Some various issues have been brought into the public eye. The CPA was also brought in front of the state legislature on two occasions, having to explain itself and how it had been conducting business previously. How do you, as the new executive director, turn around, you know, the image issues and also the fortunes of the CPA?
So I haven't had to do much turning around of the organization itself. That work was mostly completed before I arrived, specifically through a partnership with the Office of Policy and Management. I have had the opportunity to hire a new finance director for the authority since I arrived. But as you indicated, there's work to be done with respect to public perception of the authority. And, you know, I see that as getting done by doing good work, delivering projects and generally getting things done.
One of those big projects we've sort of touched upon, it's also one of the most contentious projects that the CPA is involved in, and that is the redevelopment of State Pier in New London for future offshore wind projects. Why has this project brought about so much publicity and negativity, do you think?
I can't explain the negativity. I think it's an incredibly important project. I think the partnership with New England Offshore is going to lead to generational improvements to the facility, improvements that would not likely have been contemplated based on its past use. For the period of the lease, obviously, we'll be handling primarily wind components. There will be opportunity to handle other types of cargo when the terminal is not actively handling wind components. I think the industry itself has a great deal to offer to the state, both in terms of jobs and putting us on a path toward lowering our carbon emissions. Finally, after the lease period, we'll have a vastly improved facility that will last for decades.
Do you think that one of the issues might have been, sir, that the original costs which were proposed for this project a few years ago that were touted by the governor's office was that this was going to be costing around about $93 million. Actually, it's a private and also it's like a state project. So there are private companies that are putting money into this. But since then, that price has accelerated to $157 million to accommodate Cross Sound Ferries operation nearby. You do see why people may be a little bit concerned that, you know, with a project of this size and it hasn't really started yet, the costs seem to be spiraling a little bit here.
Well, I think there was one significant change in the project that, as I understand it, and that was moving the berth from the south face to the east face of the pier. And that added some $30 million or so dollars to the project. So I think that, you know, that was the significant change that was encountered.
The other thing as well is that State Pier previously did have, you know, an operator, and it was a company called Logistec. That operator changed in 2019 to Gateway, who also happened to operate the New Haven port, which we mentioned earlier. Why was there a need to change the operator? And why has the operator effectively done away with the longshoremen that, you know, that worked there? That seems to have become a rather contentious issue as well.
So I can't speak to what drove the decision to change operators. I think that it's probably good to take a fresh look at the way a terminal is being operated periodically and allowing people to come in and make a proposal on how to best operate the facility is probably a good way to do that.
why have the longshoremen sort of like effectively been sort of pushed out of the situation here? Because, you know, they've made comment about the fact that they don't seem to be getting very, very far with Gateway, the new operator, and obviously they were there previously.
So for a period of the next 2 years, approximately, the terminal will be a construction site. So there won't be traditional terminal operations happening in the terminal, which is why the longshoremen wouldn't be working then. My understanding is they have the opportunity to potentially work with other unions on the construction project. There will be a project labor agreement in place for this project. So there will be potential for other types of union labor working in the terminal during the construction period.
I want to touch upon that, actually. You brought it up, actually, at quite an apt time. Chris Frickswell, who is the president of the Associated Builders and Contractors Organization here in Connecticut, has sort of challenged the CPA over a labor clause which was put into an RFP. He feels that it's restricting the ability for, you know, other Connecticut organizations which are non-union to actually bid for work. And then he says that the CPA wasn't able to really justify why you decided to put in this labor clause. You know, Connecticut law says it can be put in if there's a justifiable reason under public interest. But, you know, what was the public interest for that, sir?
So, again, that was done before I started here. I do believe that there are good, potentially good reasons for including that, including using experienced labor to deliver the project. But other than that, I really can't speak to the issue.
It's things like this, though, that obviously aren't helping with the image issue, though, is it, for the CPA? I appreciate what you've said, that this was pre-you, so this can't just land all on your lap. But obviously now, as the new executive director, do things like that not concern you? Because, as I say, it does sort of go directly to how the CPA is perceived in the state.
Well, I mean, I guess I don't see a problem with using union labor. I mean, I think that's a traditional approach to delivering projects.
What about also the relationship between the CPA and the City of New London? How is that these days?
I feel like I have a reasonably good relationship with the City of New London. I met regularly with the mayor, even prior to beginning my work here. So I feel like we have a pretty good relationship. You know, a good fresh start for at least me with the Port Authority.
Our understanding is that, you know, the City of New London quite understandably wants to make sure that it gets compensated fairly for, you know, when State Pier ultimately is redeveloped. But there does seem to be a bit of a sticking point with regards to taxes being paid. Without getting into the weeds too much, because obviously, you know, we can do an entire sort of like interview probably just about this. I mean, is the CPA backing, you know, the City of New London? You know, do you have their backs when it comes to that?
So, you know, I think that there's a significant opportunity for the City of New London, and we would encourage them to you know, make the best of that opportunity that they can.
But my point, though, sir, is that, you know, you are the agency for, obviously, the state. I mean, they're going up against, obviously, Eversource and Orsted, the two organizations which are basically behind this state peer deal. I mean, you know, will you not be assisting them? Because obviously it surely makes in the best interest to have, as you say, a good working relationship with the host city.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to assist them in any way that I can.
There is also the point of, so like, other businesses which will be displaced, obviously, from State Pier because of the redevelopment. I just want to quickly touch upon one company in particular, because it was raised recently in the media, and that is a salt business called Driven. You've given it some extra time to obviously try and relocate its business. You know, what are the challenges realistically there, and why do these businesses have to vacate? It appears so quickly, I'm sure it isn't. So, you know, just explain to us what the challenges are there, Mr. Henshaw.
So is the question about timing?
You know, the timing thing, I mean, they were supposed to have left and obviously they couldn't. You know, I know that the CPA is also assisting with a couple of fishing firms as well. So explain to us about the timing on that, because it to us outside, it doesn't appear as if there's much actually happening at State Pier. I'm sure there is. So, yeah, if you could just help us understand the timing aspect of that.
Yeah, so there's been some significant testing going on down there, but the biggest driver is February 1st, the DOT is going to start their remediation project in the terminal. There are a number of what they call areas of concern in all over the terminal, and so they're going to be remediating those areas beginning February 1st. Obviously, you know, we want to accommodate the salt company to sell their salt this season. It's in everyone's interest to have them successfully sell that salt. So, you know, we're, as you indicated, we're planning to extend their lease on the property through January. After that, we hope to continue to accommodate them so long as we're not interfering with the construction project.
I mean, there has been some construction going on down at State Pier, but that seems to have stopped. Again, there were questions as to whether or not all the permits were in place for that. Can you just help us out with that particular situation and clarify why work appears to have stopped?
So, as far as I know, there hasn't been any construction work taking place there.
But there's been sort of like demolition work, though, sir.
Yeah, and testing and that sort of thing. But anyway, so there are some permits that are already in place to do some work on the northeast bulkhead and some of the upland work behind that. So, you know, there is work that can go on while we're waiting for our Army Corps and DEEP permits.
One of the other things I wanted to just raise with you, and this has come out today, apparently a complaint has been put in against the CPA to the State Contracting Standards Board. Do you know what that complaint is? And, you know, how will you be dealing with that?
I'm afraid I'm not familiar with the complaint is. It was not made to me, apparently. Also, I did notice on the notification that there was a reference to the New London Port Authority. I'm not sure what the reference is to.
A few final questions I want to put to you, Mr. Henshaw, and thank you for your time, is, you know, are you on time for this project? Because again, you know, getting back to the cost of this, and we've already seen it escalate, I think it's fair to say, and you've got enough experience to know this as well from obviously everything that you've done in the past, projects rarely actually, you know, happen on time or are completed on time. And obviously there is overages and there are cost increases. How do you hope to try and to avoid some of this, you know, bearing in mind, as I say, how contentious this project, you know, simply is?
We have a hard delivery date on this project of August of 2022. And so that's really going to drive decisions on, you know, how to get this project done. So it's actually, I wouldn't say it's a bit of a luxury, but it is in some senses a bit of a luxury to have a hard target date to deliver to, because it really, you know, focuses your attention on meeting that deadline and getting all the work done.
And final point I want to put to you, sir, and again, thank you ever so much for your time. What takeaway message do you have for the people who are listening to this, that the CPA sort of really has their best interests in mind? Because at the end of the day, a huge amount of taxpayers' money is going into this, as well as, you know, private money. And we keep hearing these phrases like there's going to be, you know, a lot of jobs, you know, available when this project actually happens. But I mean, you know, what is the reality of this? You know, where are these jobs actually going to come from? And is the CPA got the best interests of the state at heart for this particular project?
Yeah, as I said, I believe that the State Pier project is a tremendous opportunity for the state. There are going to be, in the near term, construction jobs created. In the longer term, there will be supply chain jobs created in the supply chain for the wind industry. It's an industry, I believe, that will be very active decades into the future. I really do think that this is a hugely promising development for the state of Connecticut. Now, there are a number of other states and ports that are interested in working with this industry. And I think that, you know, we have a leg up here. Because of our partnership, we have a customer in hand for the facility. As you may know, in New Bedford, they built a facility without a customer in hand, and it took them some time to make use of that facility. And there are going to be other terminals built specifically for the wind industry, specifically in New York and New Jersey, I think. And but we're sort of getting a head start on some of those projects. So I think that this is a huge opportunity for the state of Connecticut.
So you know, the Connecticut Port Authority really does see wind as a future thing, despite those things that you've just said, that there are other competitors out there, because this is now becoming quite a competitive industry, isn't it?
Indeed, I do.
John Henshaw, Executive Director for the Connecticut Port Authority, thank you ever so much for the interview today, for clarifying some of the points, and obviously we'll be following the continued fortunes of the CPA and the State Pier story as it continues. But in the meantime, again, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Great. Thank you very much.
Green Valley Tree LLC is proud to sponsor Connecticut East This Week. Contact Green Valley Tree LLC for all your tree removal and plant health care needs and more. Find us at greenvalleytreeworks.com or call 860-234-4041.
Time now for a look at some other stories making the headlines in the region recently. Governor Lamont signed his 85th Emergency Declaration executive order recently, enabling the state's licensed pharmacists to administer COVID-19 vaccine once it's authorized by the FDA. Nathan Tinker is the CEO of the Connecticut Pharmacist Association and says every location and organization is needed in the state to reach the community.
Having pharmacists on the front end of this process will make it faster, easier to access, and in the long run, hopefully drive those rates higher faster. Most people live within 3 to 5 miles of a pharmacy of one sort or another, so this makes it a lot easier to get children particularly vaccinated.
It's hoped the FDA will clear the use of two vaccines shortly from Pfizer and Moderna, enabling Connecticut to begin vaccinations from December 14th. Connecticut has around 900 pharmacies statewide. Of those, around 120 are independent or rural-based pharmacies. And staying with the COVID-19 vaccine, local pharmacists in the state are reporting they are being quietly approached by both Walgreens and CVS to assist in the COVID-19 vaccine rollout and administration. The two large pharmacies have been selected by the federal government to administer any approved COVID-19 vaccine to those in care facilities, but it appears both pharmacy giants are suffering from a shortage of staff nationwide that will enable them to carry out the task. In the Connecticut Examiner this week, for years plans to redevelop 5 vacant school buildings in Groton have inched ahead, but with the first project, a 280-unit apartment complex, set to break ground as soon as next year, town officials say they hope that new developments will attract many of the thousands of people who work in Groton but live elsewhere. The town of Groton owns 5 vacant school properties it would like to sell to developers. To date, developers have proposed converting 2 schools into apartments, 1 into office space, and to demolish another to make way for a new mixed-use community with apartments. The town has received applications for the 5th Pleasant Valley Elementary after soliciting bids earlier this year, but the town has not yet selected a preferred developer. It will be another year at least before work begins at Colonel Ledyard Elementary School in October. Developer Bill Bellick presented plans to build around 18 new apartment units on the site, which has been empty since the school closed in 2008. At the William Seeley School, Donmar Development plans to clear the site to build a 280-unit apartment complex in the spring or summer of 2021 if the plans are approved by the town's land use boards. In an interview with the Connecticut Examiner, Town of Groton Director of Planning and Development, John Reiner, and Economic and Community Development Manager, Paige Bronk, said there is momentum for development in Groton, especially for multifamily housing, as developers share the town's hope that they can get people to live and work in Groton rather than commuting into Pfizer or electric boat. In the day this week, the last time Governor Lamont and the tribal owners of Connecticut's 2 casinos tried to reach a deal on sports betting and online gaming, the effort ended in acrimony. But the gambling, economic, and political environment is vastly changed. For the first time, the administration is intent on putting forward a proposed framework rather than react to the legislator or tribal casino owners. and the focus is on making a deal with the tribes, not placating commercial competitors such as MGM Resorts International. Perhaps most significantly, Lamont also is dropping his opposition to so-called iGaming and is ready to emulate New Jersey and Pennsylvania, where the state's gambling laws allow every adult the convenience of turning their smartphone, laptop, or iPad into a virtual 24/7 casino. Another factor is that the pandemic has left the state and the casinos hungry for new revenue sources. Due to COVID-19, the two casinos, Foxwoods Resort and Mohegan Sun, closed on March 18th for the first time since they opened. They have since reopened at limited capacity, but revenues are sharply down. In the Norwich Bulletin this week, the same week Killingley Town Hall reopened to the public, two other Windham County towns opted to either shutter their doors to residents or extend already in place closures in reaction to rising COVID-19 cases in the region. After a two-week COVID-related public closure, several Killingley municipal buildings reopened for resident access recently. Also, Plainfield First Selectman Kevin Cunningham announced Town Hall would be closed to normal traffic through to at least December 21st after four staff members recently tested positive for the virus. Just over 2 weeks ago, an employee said he wasn't feeling well and ended up testing positive, Cunningham said. Then three other staff members called out of work and also tested positive. Cunningham said the staff member who first tested positive has since completed a 14-day quarantine and has returned to work after receiving a negative test result. In the Middletown Press this week, UConn women's basketball has resumed full team 5 days earlier than anticipated following multiple negative tests amongst players, according to the school. The third-ranked Huskies had been practicing in small groups since November 28, 5 days after halting activities due to a positive COVID-19 test within the program's Tier 1 bubble. Assuming no further setbacks, the Huskies will tip off their season against UMass Lowell at Gampel Pavilion. Tier 1 individuals, generally consisting of players, coaches, trainers, and practice players, have been tested 3 times a week per NCAA recommendations. The program reported another positive case during the shutdown, but it did not affect the quarantine timeline. That individual was not identified. The Huskies had been scheduled to tip off their season against Quinnipiac on November 28th at Mohegan Sun. However, that was cancelled, as were games against Mississippi State Maine on November 29th and Louisville on December 4th. The Big East opener against Seton Hall was postponed from December 6th to December 17th. In the Chronicle this week, after many months waiting for a new liver, Mansfield Fire Department Captain Ted Morissette was on the verge of dying. However, a donor was found just in the nick of time. And as a result, Morissette is now recovering at home after a liver transplant in late October and more than a month at Hartford Hospital. He said he does not know anything about the donor, but if he had the opportunity, he would thank that individual for the gift of life. I can't really express the feelings because, like I said, I was probably 24 hours from death myself, said Morissette, who turned 58 the day before he returned to home. The liver transplant occurred about 18 years after he was diagnosed with primary biliary cholangitis, or PBC. Morissette's donor liver came from a deceased donor, according to Mansfield Fire Chief Fran Rayola. He said the town and the fire department are grateful for not only the donor, but for all people who are organ donors. And in next week's Connecticut East this week, Marissa Gillette, the chairman of Connecticut's Public Utilities Regulatory Authority, or PURA, talks to us about the organization's recent ruling that makes sweeping changes to how Eversource and United Illuminating charge for the delivery portion of your electricity bill and what it means going forward. And she talks about how PURA is putting its foot down more than it has ever before. Plus, the cost of your prescription medications may be getting cheaper after the Trump administration issued a new rule on prescription drug rebates recently. But does it go far enough in helping the consumer? We talked to the National Community Pharmacists Association to get their take on what it all means. And we'll also be talking the latest on the COVID-19 vaccine situation and what it means for everyone. That's all from us for this edition. Do send us your questions and story ideas to the show via our website at connecticut-east.com or Facebook or Twitter at Connecticut East, where you can also listen to the show again on demand. And please like, follow and share on your social media platforms too. I'm Brian Scott Smith. Thank you for listening.